an interview with Professors Bloom and Chairman Bowne of the Department of French and Italian, December 5th.
Or that there are people who have talked a lot about Oyster Bay, and then the toll period, but then period which was his own period as
62 to 65. Right. Well, now let me run through some of these questions. And I want to make sure this is going. And then after that we can be as unstructured as necessary. Name, department, rank, or position. You first.
Okay, Carol Blum, yes. French and Italian, Professor of French.
Professor of French. And you?
Frederick Brown, Department of French and Italian, also Professor of French.
All right. Two, what year did you come to Stony Brook?
1962.
You came in 1962?
Yes.
Same year I did.
Do you remember me?
Yes, I do remember.
Do you?
Yes, right.
We had an interview that first day, I think.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Next question.
When did you come?
I came in 1965.
You came in 1965.
Yes.
Now, you don't have to answer this. How old were you at the time?
This is depressing.
Oh, God. I guess I was 28.
28?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was 31.
And you were 31.
Yeah.
Three, from what institution and position did you come?
I was an instructor at Columbia.
At Columbia.
Mm-hmm. My position I had immediately before this was as a program officer for an institute foundation called the African American Institute. I had left academia for 1 year. Mm-hmm. Before that, I had taught at Harper College.
Harper. Mm-hmm. The core of Binghamton.
In Binghamton, right?
Yes.
Exactly.
The
African American.
American. Where was that located?
In New York City.
In New York City.
Yeah.
All right. Who was primarily responsible for your coming to Stony Brook?
Seymour Flaxman.
Seymour Flaxman. He was chairman of the Department of
Foreign Languages
foreign
and
languages.
Literatures. They and finally worked out that
at
title.
At that time. And who was
Seymour Flaxman?
Seymour Flaxman. All right. Five. And who interviewed you for the position here?
I think it was just Seymour Flaxman.
Seymour.
I recall that I met Lynette Brugmans and Ivan Tosh.
Did you?
Ivan Tosh. Yes, those are the only two. I believe there were two. I suppose it was the summer. I was hired under rather peculiar circumstances because somebody had dropped dead in the middle of the summer.
Oh, I see.
And they needed someone at the last minute. Yeah.
I see.
And actually, you yourself interviewed me.
I did?
Yes.
I see. All right. Now, why did you come? What factors were most important in your decision?
Well, at that point, I needed a job.
Yes.
And,
That occurs every to all of us.
Yes, right. I wanted to be close to New York, so
yes.
I took the job that was closest to New York that was available.
I see.
At that time, jobs were just starting to get hard to find in French, and it circled outward from New York. You could still find jobs anywhere else in the country, except New York.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, now why was that?
Well, I think that there had been a real lack of trained PhDs during that education boom of the early 60s. And there had been really jobs for just about anybody with a PhD. And then little by little, the market started to close down, and New York City being one of the most desirable places. It closed down first.
I see.
So there were jobs ringed around New York, but there was nothing right in New York.
I see. And what about you?
Pretty much the same. I left the academic world thinking that perhaps I might prefer foundation work, and I was quickly disabused.
Mm-hmm.
And decided to teach again, but I encountered the same problem. Living in New York, and I would have preferred to teach in New York, but there were no positions available.
I see.
By that time, it was 65, and even more difficult to find a position.
Mm-hmm.
So I applied to various places, including Stony Brook, and at the very last moment, for reasons I explained,
mm-hmm.
I heard from Seymour Flaxman.
What was your understanding?
Excuse me, I should add.
Yes.
That another reason I wanted to get into the academy, because I realized that in foundation work I didn't have time to write.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very important reason for me.
Right.
And I had a contract to write a book,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to do that.
Mm-hmm. What was your understanding of the purposes behind the creation of Stony Brook? What did you know about Stony Brook?
I found out there was a job opening, made an appointment, rented a car, and was hired all on the same day. So I really didn't know what I was getting into very well.
I see.
Except through one person who's no longer here, who's now the president of Bennington, Elizabeth Coleman, who was an instructor in the English department at that point, and who had been at Oyster Bay. So she sort of filled me in very quickly about what the whole enterprise had been about, or as she saw it. And my impression was of a very, it's not the Wild West because it's East, but it was a very experimental, sort of the opposite of a traditional
institution
with a curriculum that has been settled. It seems everything seemed to be up in the air, which was very stimulating and exciting, and also a little bit disconcerting. That was my first impression.
Quite different from Columbia.
Totally different from
yes.
Columbia. Yeah.
But you came to this campus. You were never in Oyster Bay.
I was never in Oyster Bay.
What did I know about Stony Brook? I remember, seem to remember, that when I was still at Harper College, I'd heard sort of good noises about Stony Brook.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, I seem to remember that it was already designated as a university center. Was it not?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And that conferred a certain prestige on it, which... And I'm not sure that Binghamton was yet designated as a university center. When I went, it was still Harper College.
Yes.
At any rate, the only other thing I can say I had heard about Stony Brook was that it was said to be primarily a scientific school.
Yes.
And that there was an attempt being made to build up the non-scientific curricula divisions, but as I said, I was told that it had begun. I seem to recall as an engineering school, and that I know. Well, but this is the rumor.
These are the rumors.
These are the rumors.
Right.
And that it was strong in science and not very strong in anything else yet.
I see. All right. What were your impressions of Stony Brook when you first came? The campus, the people, the leadership, the spirit?
But it was a rainstorm and it looked like a huge construction site.
Yes.
I sort of wandered from one construction gang to another asking if anybody knew where the humanities building was.
Yes.
And when I finally found it, tried to get a cup of coffee, was told that only the construction gangs had coffee. And they were just putting the windows in the Humanities Building that day. So
this was September of 62.
Yeah.
September.
Right, September. And classes had already started. So it all seemed very, very alien, kind of overwhelming.
Why didn't you turn around and go back to New York?
I said I needed a job.
I see.
Morse Peckham, who was chairman of the department at Columbia at that time, I remember saying to me, this is going to be the school of the future, and if you can get in on the ground floor with this institution, you will have a wonderful future. And I remember thinking how silly, I'll stay a year or two at most. So that was 26 years ago.
Yes. This was the question is, what were my initial impressions?
No, yes. When you first came, the campus, the people, the leadership, the spirit.
Oh, well, of course, it was difficult the first day to gain any idea of the leadership. And it was the summer, as I said. I came in August, and of course, it was mostly deserted. And I thought it was... it struck me as being very provincial. It's a small provincial. I had come from first Yale, and then for 3 years I taught at the University of Texas. And these are, you know, physically, just from that point of view, large and established. And it was extremely primitive. It seemed really quite primitive and small still. That was a strong initial. I don't remember too much else, actually. Impressions began to gather in September when the semester began. Also, bear in mind the fact that when I came, the very man who hired me was about to leave as chairman, and the new chairman had not quite arrived yet. So it seemed a little bit chaotic.
Who was the new chairman?
The new chairman was Oscar Hawk.
Who
had come up from Emory, who was coming up from Emory, hadn't arrived yet. And here's not only was Flack stepping down from chairman, but the entire department of foreign language and literatures being restructured.
Mm-hmm.
It was no longer one department. It was being divided into Romance languages and Germanic, I think it's called.
Germanic
and Slavic. So I didn't know what to expect. It was unknown.
I remember the first day in class asking, the book that we were reading was a play, and asking students in French what play they had seen recently, getting an absolute zero, and asking them what plays they had ever seen. Did they ever go to New York? You know. Finally, have you ever been to New York? And I couldn't believe I was really asking this question of young people 50 miles or 60 miles from the city, and out of a class of 30, two or three raised their hands who had ever been to New York City. And I really thought, where am I?
Yeah, I should add also that I was interviewed, I'm quite sure, yes I was, by Stanley Ross. I think that meant a lot to me. I have an extremely good impression of him.
In what way?
He seemed to be both intelligent and forceful.
Yes.
Alert. I liked him very much. Also, of course, I didn't turn around either because of his job. But I must say, Ross made a good impression. Very good impression.
All right. I selected him as dean because I came originally as acting chief administrative officer and dean of arts and sciences.
I see.
Both hats.
Gosh.
And it didn't take me long to realize that...
You couldn't wear two hats.
I couldn't wear two hats.
Yeah.
I needed somebody.
It was a good choice.
Good. I'm glad you feel that way. All right. Now, what events, what persons, what experiences stand out in your mind? I think Lynette Berglund was here, wasn't she?
No, she came after
I did. She came after you did. I see. All right. Tell what you can about the life of the department.
Are we into the unstructured part of the interview yet?
I think we could say yes. This is question 9, and you can be as unstructured as you like.
Well, I think I was probably rather cranky. And I had, I guess, unrealistically high expectations of what the department should be and what the students' education should be. Mm-hmm. And I was very much oriented to Columbia's humanities sequence type of foundation, educational foundation. So I became pretty quickly involved in efforts to set up something similar for our students. And many people in that department were very much opposed to really any requirements and felt that that was a sort of passé element in higher education, and that Stony Brook represented the education of the future, not the past, and that we should have sort of infinite flexibility. So there was already a kind of polarization.
Who were some of these people that
What's going to become of these interviews? Who's going to hear them?
They're going into the archives, and the only person that is likely to see them is a person who will probably later on be writing a history of the institution.
Very significant.
So that there won't be any searching out of choice bits.
Okay.
Well, what can I say?
So you did have a difference of point of view.
Yes, we definitely did.
Well, I'm interested, actually, myself in knowing who represented me. Are you talking about the entire 60s now, or just the first year?
I don't know. I just remember several years of struggles over curriculum.
Was I yet here?
Yes, going into the time when you were here. For example, Norman Laidlaw made me chairman of a committee that was to draw up a humanities sequence, precisely. And on the committee there were Conrad Bieber, Oscar Hock, and several other people whose names I've forgotten. Well, in the first place, it was sort of silly to put a young assistant professor on a committee as chairman of a committee with full professors. Kind of hard to admit. And I didn't have the political savvy to know when to shut up, I think, basically. And I very much felt that these young people needed, an education in the largest possible sense.
Yeah.
That was the best gift I thought that we had to give them. The other people felt just the opposite, that that was the dead hand of the past and that should be destroyed. So we had, in essence, sort of honorable disagreements, I think, because they were really about principles.
Where did Conrad...
Conrad was very much opposed to any kind of uniformity or requirements. He was a libertarian in the most extreme. And
where did he come from?
Connecticut College.
He came from Connecticut College.
He'd been chairman of the French department at Connecticut College for women.
New London.
And before that, I guess he's in Yale, and then he's from Berlin originally, wasn't he?
Yeah. I see. Yeah. A German, but teaching French.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know too much about his background. I know that he was in France during the war. Mm-hmm. German Jewish.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had a number of Germans teaching French.
Yeah. Oscar Hock, Wall Street.
Elianor
Zimmerman.
He's German.
I know, Swiss anyway.
She's born in England.
That's certainly my memory too. I think it can fairly be said that Carol and I have been allies from the beginning in that sense. representing what we consider to be certain prerequisites
yes.
for an undergraduate education. We found ourselves, I would say by and large, rather isolated. At Stony Brook, increasingly isolated during the 60s.
I'm surprised that Lynette wasn't in your camp, so to speak.
It's hard to say. At that point, one gets into matters of personality.
Yes.
I mean, it's not, as you know, departmental affairs are not purely intellectual or ideological, all sorts of personal collisions, clashes, disaffections that enter into this, and often people will espouse issues in which they are profoundly believe out of dislike for people who, and so on. I didn't go into that any further, but certainly the department did split both ideologically and personally in many ways out of that sense.
Also, remember that during those years, the department was enormous. From the time I came until Fred came, where we were just Department of Romance Language, we were hiring people right and left. I know Seymour Flaxman hired people over the phone. Were so loose.
My goodness, without interviewing?
I think there were, well, that was a legend at any rate. The numbers were getting greater and the need was acute. So there were just mobs of people who came in and out of that department before it finally kind of shut down and stayed for a decade or so without any change.
It's hard to say. I mean, my feeling looking back is that Carol's and mine expectations were too great. Perhaps we thought we wanted to do too much with students, or expected too much of them. On the other hand, I still think that that the opposite camp simply tended to find a kind of deprecatory view
yes.
of undergraduates at Stony Brook, that they're not up to studying certain things. And then what entered this was the whole ethos of the 60s,
mm-hmm.
The abolition of requirements. This was the ancien regime. We were going to do away with all of that. We were going to study what was immediately relevant and so on and so forth. And again, we who both of us, I think, yield to the ideal of a classical education in some ways, at least some sense of the historical tradition. We had a very hard time getting our way in anything. We were certainly in a small minority,
mm-hmm.
very small minority. And I'm a little disappointed, finally. I felt that Stony Brook lost years in some ways because of that, because of those that ideological uproar, frankly.
And this was in the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very definitely. The 60s, but it didn't end in 1970. It really continued, and I continued a long time here, I think, a long time after it had ceased to be the case in other universities, which had regained a sort of somewhat more conservative spirit, with Harvard leading the way. But Stony Brook, I think in many ways, has always lagged in that way. It has, certain things tend to become entrenched here. I would say that was one of the things that became entrenched, I think, that a certain kind of radical spirit. And I don't think, freely, I don't think the administration during that period, I don't think the administration was a very strong one. I don't think that it was strong enough, and this is, certainly they were in very good company, this was happening throughout universities throughout the country. I don't think that they really examined the issues closely enough and opposed the radical elements forcefully enough.
Well, now are you
talking about, first of all, I think one problem has been that in that regard is that we've had scientific presidents who feel very would feel themselves to be on a treacherous ground when they enter the humanities.
Yes.
They don't feel they know exactly what people are talking about. They're afraid to take stands. And I think that Toll is no exception to that. On the other hand, I imagine principal advisors, Sidney Gelber, was not a strong force in the administration.
Well, he was.
I liked him personally, but I didn't think
I wouldn't agree with you that he wasn't strong. I think he was. His agenda was very much the agenda of the late 60s, though.
Well,
surprisingly enough, I mean, coming from where he came from.
Yes, well, he came from Colombia,
yeah.
And from contemporary civilization.
Well, I disagree with you. I don't think it was a question of strength. I think it was a question of weakness, because my profound sense is that Gelber succumbed. I don't think these were his values, but I think that he was rather overwhelmed by a very vehement, noisy, youngish assistant and some associate professors on the back of it. I don't think he stood deeply for what he probably believed. Yeah, and that was my humor. I found it very disappointing. I became somewhat disaffected during that period. I didn't really participate. I was opposed to just so many things that were going on. The scrapping of language prerequisites, and the scrapping almost everything else. These students were ignorant enough as it was, and this was a sort of consecration of their ignorance. As I saw it, and I think we're still paying for it to this day.
Would you agree with that?
Well, I guess it's the. I mean, you're bringing back memories of so many efforts and struggles, and.
Yeah.
What am I trying to say? There was also, as a teacher in those early years, I felt that my job was in some way to force the students to take in as much, assimilate as much, and grow as much as possible. The model was almost a sort of disciplinary model. Somewhere along the line came the student evaluations. And that was interesting because I, particularly in these courses that were modeled on the Columbia model, I was treated without much affection by the students, and I was very, very hurt by that. And it was years later that I would get feedback from students saying, when I took that course of yours, I hated it, and I hated those quizzes, and I thought you were awful. And now, 10 years later, I can say that was the best course I ever had.
Okay.
But that kind of lag effect, I think, was wiped out by the student evaluations, from which I learned, as we all did, how to get good student evaluations, when that became an important element. And that was part of the radicalism, too. And it's obviously a two-headed sword. I mean, the teacher who pays no attention to the students' reactions is not doing the job. The student who pays only attention, I mean, the teacher who only pays attention is also to be questioned in that way. But that was, I think, another watershed, and that must have been in the middle 60s. And then after that, I found it impossible to give a course as rigorous as I was giving before.
Well, you were also at the mercy of the kind of students that the high schools were turning out.
That's
right.
And also the lack of a fundamental or first-rate cultural background in many of the families.
Yes.
Because you're dealing with first-generation college. And You had several strikes against you in this sense.
From a somewhat different point of view, I mean, thinking of the atmosphere of Stony Brook in those years in the 60s and how it's changed. How are we doing with the...
All right? Yes.
I have always been a commuter.
Yes.
During the first 5 to 8 years I taught Stony Brook, I was in numerous company. I am no longer, and that says a lot about what's happened to Stony Brook.
You were what kind of company?
I was in numerous company.
Yes.
In the early years. There were many people on the faculty who lived in New York.
Right.
And commuted. That has changed for various reasons. The university has grown much larger. New York has become unaffordable, completely unaffordable. That wasn't the case in the 60s at all. There was a campaign to discourage, perhaps you recall that, to discourage people from living in New York. New candidates for positions were actually asked where they intended to live. I decided to do this for all kinds of personal and quite necessary reasons to continue to live in New York. But what can we say about it as far as it affects the personality of Stony Brook? I mean, it has acquired more of a personality than it had under the personality gels to a greater extent. Mm-hmm. With people, with faculty members, in the great majority living here. I think that's the case. I'm wondering to what extent it has also lost a little something. It was been quite wild. It was a really chaotic atmosphere, people living all over the place and coming in, disappearing. In some ways, I think probably profited from the intellectual resources of New York, of people living in New York, and that it was found itself in a very difficult position. I think that probably one of the sort of congenital difficulties of Stony Brook, the fact that it is as close as it is to New York, but in a certain sense, really quite far away. I mean, it's been hard, I think, to achieve an identity at this sort of middle distance from the great city. Is a feeling. Maybe I'm quite wrong, because after all, Rutgers is no further away, and Princeton and so on. Perhaps it has something to do with being on an island, and the only direction to go in is really New York.
Well, there aren't two ferries, but...
you know what I mean.
Yes, I think that was... there was always that tension. I remember stories the first year I was here of the person who preceded you as CEO having talked about helicopters that would go from New York to the campus. And perhaps you remember when Governor Rockefeller came for the opening ceremony of one of those new buildings down at the campus.
Yes.
And he talked about the bullet train that was going to from Manhattan out here, which was probably 20 minutes or something like that. So the notion of somehow being attached quickly and rapidly to the city, I think, was always part of the fantasy of Stony Brook. And I think that that's part of what put Stony Brook on the map, because just many excellent, interesting people could come out and teach who would not go to Albany, for example. I think
Alfred Kazin is an example of that.
Mm.
But it worked both ways.
Yes.
That's right. It certainly did. And I'm not rationalizing. In certain important ways, because I live in New York, I've not been able to devote myself to the university as much as I would if I lived here.
Yeah.
Not served on committees as much as I would have in that foremost. I mean, I certainly see students
on the other hand, you've made...
I've made contributions in writing, it's true. Yeah. I spent a lot of time writing. I also have to say, Dr. Hartzell, that... I don't know. I think that I have various thoughts. One thought is a memory which I don't want to forget. I remember that very, very distinctly, Rockefeller's visit. And the thing I remember most distinctly about it was his pointing to the campus with a sweeping gesture and referring to this beautiful campus, whereupon the entire audience began to laugh. Because we were, up to our ankles in mud still, and...
When did that must have been, 65 or 66?
Well, it was within a year or two of my coming. It must have been the 60s. I wasn't 65, I don't think it was 60, maybe it was 65. It was certainly in the middle 60s, you know.
Remember what building you...
I have a suspicion it was the...
Earth and Space Science.
Earth and Space Science, yeah. That's where it was held, right in front. Over there,
like the jungle at that point.
Yeah, that was sort of the outermost limit of the. I feel that returning to the question of identity, that I didn't in those years, and I still don't. I have a feeling. That and part of this is really a matter of architecture, I think. That Stony Brook has a center, and certainly new faculty always wonder about this, always worry about it, and express concern. There isn't a place in this campus, a lounge, a faculty, something or other, where people can simply drop in and have a cup of coffee or tea, a pleasant, and I think that it was a very serious error not to have taken this into consideration in the first. I feel that architecture is a crucial thing in the construction of a new university, and I think we really missed out. California colleges are beautifully designed, and more quickly achieved a sense of coherence and personality that Stony Brook has. It's still, to this day, and eating places are not really all that pleasant.
Have you been over to the...
To the chemistry building?
Chemistry building.
Yeah, I've been over. It's not... It's okay. It's the way I feel. It's not really a place where I'm likely to linger. But I'm also talking simply of a sort of club.
Yeah.
A lounge, a tea room. I mean, there's such a place.
A faculty club.
In every university I've taught in. And
It's an important place.
It's an important place.
Yeah. Well, I guess it was not on John Toll's agenda.
No, it sure wasn't. This was a funny place. I remember there was a friend who taught Russian here, Barry Rubin, who's been gone for a number of years. He and I used to play tennis. So we play tennis, and then the next week we go to play tennis, and the tennis court would be torn up, and they'd be building a building, and then you start looking for where they put the tennis court. Well, they must have moved tennis courts 3 times. And I was always thinking that, $2,000 per court times 6 courts times 3 times you could have built. But there was that feeling of sort of improvising a new plan every...
Yes, exactly. Of improvisation, such a strong feeling of improvisation. And in fact, our own French department offices have been... we've been here for quite a long period now, but during those years,
we
were moving all the time, from one year to the next. I didn't know what floor I was going to be on.
Let me ask you this question. The sciences have individual buildings.
Yes.
Chemistry and physics and math.
Yes.
The social sciences are together in one large building.
Yes.
And the biological sciences are together in another large building.
Yes.
The humanities are scattered all over the campus.
Yes.
would it make make sense, and would the humanities people be happy if there was an attempt made to erect a large humanities building which would bring together not only English and literature, but the languages and philosophy, religion, and possibly history if the social sciences building becomes too small.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It is interesting.
And put it fairly close to the library. If there's probably only one good place still left. And that's right close. When I came, I was amazed that they had put the chemistry and the biology buildings closest to the library, and so close that in the case of chemistry that there wouldn't be any possibility for much expansion of the library.
That's right.
That was already done
when
I came. And humanities are off quite a ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, when Robert Neville was dean, I was chairman of a committee of foreign language development of all the languages, and we had subcommittees, and one of them was on long-term space, and we were given to understand that there would be a humanities tower, and we worked out a plan for languages within that context, a very lovely plan with a language, state-of-the-art language laboratory and computer laboratory, and the languages all sort of clustering around that. But then that's been 3 years now. I haven't heard anything more about that. Yes, I think it would probably be a very positive sign to the
possibly
humanities.
With a cafeteria in the middle.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Have to have. In fact, we even suggested there be various, you know, a little thé pâtisserie and a little Italian place to give a little, also to the students, to have a place to meet and have some feeling of conviviality.
Yeah, so long as it's a place where people really want to go and eat. I think it's one of the unfortunate things about Stony Brook, and I never understood quite why it's been so difficult to create a cafeteria where people would really like to, where for one thing, the food is really reasonably good. I don't think it is anything the places I've eaten at. I mean, you don't find this at other universities. The City University Graduate Center has a marvelous cafe, all sorts of places. Why? Perhaps catering services? At any rate, that's incidental. I think that, yes, it would be a good idea to have the all of these disciplines together in a single place. At the same time,
architecture has the tendency to separate on this campus.
Yes.
But you could also bring them together.
Yes.
If you're going to keep the building close to the library, it's got to go up because there isn't that much space.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it should be kept close to the library.
Yeah.
In some ways, it's very wonderful to be in the library itself.
Yes,
and that,
that's right.
That I've enjoyed.
Yeah. But the library itself is going to grow.
It has to.
Mm-hmm. They've got purchasing in there now. And a good deal of the academic administration on the east side.
Certainly, purchasing doesn't have to be logically in the library.
Well, originally they were going to add to the administration building, and how the garage got put where they were going to put the administration building, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
Those things happen.
Yeah. Where would the site be for such a building? You say there's only one left.
I think I think it would be the other end of this horseshoe, where you have the fine arts building, and then the theater and the main stage, and the library. And be open. It's open now.
That plaza?
This plaza here?
I'm not thinking immediately of the plaza, but just beyond where it's sunken, a building going up without getting into the main sweep of the open mall, so to speak. I think that's about the only place that it could go.
Dr. Hartzell, we've been talking about faculty, but there's also there are also the students we talked about, and I think what applies to faculty can also be said of students. This is a complaint I started hearing way back when, and I guess students, the older it gets, the less inclined students are to speak confessorially to me, but it's still the same. The same problem exists for them. Where do they congregate? There are no really very agreeable places. They don't seem to speak about the individual colleges. But then, of course, there are a lot of people commuting. There's something called the commuters' study lounge downstairs. It's a shabby place. That is another problem, having to do with architecture, really, in a way. One of the real paradoxes of Stony Brook is that the student